well, welcome everybody to the Room 42 Green Room. This is a place for a small group discussion where we invite guests to come and share their insights and their opinions based on their practical experience in the field. These sessions are unique. They're completely unscripted and unrehearsed. We're going to talk about a topic that is of interest and of interest today and see it from different perspectives. And we'll find out what happens through the course of the conversation and what lessons we can all learn together. So today, I want to welcome our Green Room guests. And we have Larry Kuntz, Carsten Wade, Stephen Young, and Dr. Lucia Dura. And all of these people have been invited to come and share their thoughts and opinions. They all have a certain passion around the topic of inclusion and inclusive words. And they've all agreed to give up their time to come share their thoughts and insights and some pointers. So we're going to discuss inclusive language, how it impacts our work, and share some common mistakes that people make along the way, possibly talk about how we can work together to maybe do something as creative as create an industry-wide inclusive dictionary so we can look for words or standards that help us all do better and be better with language. All right. Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate it. And I'm going to start it out with just a silly question and open for anyone to answer. But why is inclusive language important?
From a business perspective, companies are trying to get money from as many people as possible. And if there's a segment of the population that doesn't want to do business with them because of the language that they use, that's bad for business. So just from a cold business perspective, get money from as many people as possible.
Now, modern marketing is more and more about the personal. It used to be just broadcast, advertised in the mass media to everyone the same message. Not anymore. It's very personal. And you see the websites trying to get all your personal information so they know what ads to feed to you. We don't want to have people feel excluded, whether it's marketing or whether it's technical documentation, whether it's software interfaces. We want everyone to feel comfortable and included.
Right.
Welcome. So that's why it's important. And as Steve said, if you don't do that, your competitors will, and it's bad for your business.
From a different perspective, I think it's also, I see inclusion as additive. This isn't about including somebody else so that then they can take other people's place. It's just having more perspectives at the table. And that certainly enriches conversation, enriches design, and it helps us do better, I think.
Nick, you go ahead,
Carson. Yeah, I was just thinking about the inner, just the way that since language is so representative, that the language, it's just even narrowing it on a business example, the language you're using to talk about your customers and your partners and the whole market, if you're using language that is information technology and technology industry, we see war metaphors or sports metaphors or things like that used all the time, and when a customer site becomes a hill that has to be taken or something, we've now shifted over. And even if you're not saying it to their face, you're talking about that internally there. I think it's going to bring a different attitude. It's going to bring something there. So you get, by changing your external language, it gives you a chance to change your internal and reflexive language. And if you make your external and internal line up, then you get rid of all of those. And you also clarified your language too, because what's a hill to be taken until you understand all the details of what that metaphor means, when it's more easy to use a simple term like a goal to achieve or something like that.
Right. Because word choices matter, and they're important, and they set an emotive tone, right? For the company, like you said, if you're really aggressive, you're going to end up with a lot of aggression. And it makes, I think, a lot easier for a lot more people to access the information. I mean, I think of it from a perspective of somebody who, tries to write information that's going to inform or instruct somebody, that I want to make sure that I'm using language that's not going to be, you know, a little like make them just a little off put because they lose the message, right? If I'm using phrases that are might be offensive, even if they're not intentional, but they might be offensive, then that person is a little off put, I think, and how they're going to interact with the content that I'm providing for them, instructions to do a task. I think it will influence their receptiveness, right?
Yeah, and they may not even realize it, but they'll have that sense of, I don't belong here. This is not a place where I'm welcome.
Right. Right.
And you can go from being welcome to seeing people in roles that they didn't see themselves in before. And I have a concrete example in mind, but some of my work involves being on the board of the Texas Center for Legal Ethics. And one of the things that we recently did, or I helped them do, is every month they have a case that goes out to the legal community. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those difficult ethical cases. But if we write that I'm going to mix this up because I'm not an attorney.
That's okay.
But, you know, I remember one of the cases was like somebody was inheriting to their children. And so this was about an inheritance. And if the person that was inheriting was conceptually defined as white based on their name only, and the lawyer was white based on their name, what assumptions are we putting out there versus showing some diversity, that there could be a landowner who it happens to be Mexican or Black or something else. Right. And so giving other perspectives so that people can imagine that there are attorneys who are not white in Texas, or there are landowners who are not white, and almost like painting those people into the landscape that people imagine. I think it's that can have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
You know, what that flashes on me is the something else, Lucia, that you brought up earlier about the zero sum thinking. You know, is there enough pie for everybody? And it feels like that fear that there's not enough, that if I give up this word, then that's going to erase me somehow. You know, really comes in, and then you imagine that being erased versus the picture you just draw, where by drawing people into the picture and saying there's room for everybody, and it's that opposite of erasing. I think. You know, a lot of this may be that we sometimes it's just these one-on-one conversations of talking to people and just hearing out their particular concern and fear and helping them see that transition over about how to make a difference. Because that's some of the stuff that I've been seeing in the community work that we've been doing is when everyone wants to posture in front of everybody else, that's when it's time to start breaking out the, you know, it's 1984 new speak or whatever that are completely, anyway, won't go down, you know, and it, as compared to when you really can hear somebody out and get them off of them, you know, off of the high fence.
Right. So you mean like if they're being resistive to
changing
phrases? Yeah. Sensitive. Yeah.
I think afraid really as well. It feels to me a lot of times a lot of this stuff is fear, especially when someone's coming angry or aggressive. It's like, that's, you know, why are you fighting, or, you know, why do you feel attacked?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we kind of hold on to words too, right? We get an attachment. It's like you're talking about the iconography, right? And these are icons that we grew up with. So, you know, why isn't everybody else get on board with it? And yet there's a whole generation that have no idea what a floppy disk is. A floppy what? Right? Yeah. So, you know,
when they're trying to use a user interface, the visual clue's not there for them until they get taught that one. There's not, the intuition isn't, the evolution hasn't happened. I mean, I'm not a user interface expert, so there's probably good reasons why we phase things in and phase things out over time.
Right. But I mean, another thing with words and inclusive language is because, think about the times where someone who comes from a different culture, and we might use a word that they don't comprehend the same way we do. And if we're trying to give them an instruction manual to repair something, and we're using words that they don't understand, then we've just, you know, sabotaged their ability to perform the task.
Words, right? That have a different connotation in their culture.
That's a great point. And it's a good argument for simplified English or simplified language, where you use fewer words, but try to be very careful about how you use them. I think that what you're saying is quite true when coming up with examples or analogies. I think I'm thinking of like architectural analogies. I have been in the business for a long time, and for I think almost the whole time when we would talk about certain kind of architectural ideas, we'd fall back on what we think are common situations. I'm thinking specifically about mailboxes. I can't tell you how many different software products communicate through mailboxes, and there's always the same architectural picture with a sort of an icon of a mailbox. And it was only in recent years that I realized when I think of a mailbox, I think of a suburban on a post mailbox, open the door, get the mail, and go back in the house mailbox, which is only for a certain part of a certain country. And more than half of the world is in an urban setting where a mailbox is in a bank of things on a wall and you unlock the door and you open it up, or some other analogy. And it actually affects your thinking if the image that you have in mind is not the image that the reader has in mind. And if half of the world has no idea what you're talking about when you say mailbox, you're not really communicating with them.
Right. And what you are communicating in a sense is this is kind of the dominant language or architecture. And so you will adapt to it because it's dominant, and also you will aspire to it. That message is, I don't know if it's explicit or implicit, but.
But that raises a question, something that I've been thinking about around simplified language and been talking around a little bit. Is, let me ask this and see what you think. Is there any advantage or disadvantage to having to putting simplified language as an argument or first, or sort of putting or insisting on inclusivity and the experience of the humans on the other side? So one puts the experience of humans in terms of their confusion, and the other puts the experience of humans in terms of their identity in the world, right? What advantages and disadvantages are there by putting either one of those in first if we have a dictionary or something we're putting out, and there's, here's the reasons why you want to change this word over. Are we going to start with simplified language block? Or are we going to start with, this other block?
It's a Venn diagram with a big overlap.
Yeah.
it really is. And I think we talked about globalization and localization 10, 20 years ago. Don't use that mailbox that Steve described, because most of the world doesn't know what it is. Now we're talking more about, as Karsten said, what people see as their identity, who they are. Do we use carelessly terms? The classic example in the computer industry is master and slave.
Yes.
We have carelessly used those for a long time, and now we see that those are highly offensive to some people. And what do we do about that? Do we keep on using them? No, I don't think so. As Steve said before, it's bad business if we do, because people are going to be turned away.
It's funny you should mention that, Larry. I can actually go back and directly remember when I first started in the business, that was an acceptable term, and it was used in an architectural sense.
Yes.
And I remember the first time, at least at the company I was at, 40 years ago, the first people who said, maybe we shouldn't use the terms master and slave. And that was resisted fiercely by the engineers, the software engineers, who said, master and slave is exactly the right technical term. There is no other word and phrase, no other combination of words that expresses what master and slave means. You can't change it. And at least 40 years ago, that carried the day. It didn't change for a long time. And more recently, people have come back and said, no, it really is offensive and you don't need to say it. We could say other things. It's only within the last couple of years that it made it to my current employer's style guide. The tech pubs group, the corporate group said, take it out. Take it out of our documentation. Take it out of the product. And we, there is no longer any resistance to that. and you know, we are taking it out, except when the software uses it. And there it becomes a problem. We are now filing bug reports that said it uses this term.
Right.
Literally today, I was reading one of our product manuals evaluatively, and I came across it in the software. It's in network configuration files. There's master and slave. And yeah. I don't think we can take it out because it won't work if you don't use those terms. I think we can all help by pushing all of our employers to remove it, not just from the books, but from the software. It may be difficult, but you know, the tide has certainly turned. I haven't heard anybody arguing in favor of those terms in a long time.
Right. That's you bring up a good point too, that some of these words and phrases that we've used for years and years and years, like master slave, that goes back into the automotive days and working on vehicles, the old cars that, you know, didn't have all the electronics back in the day.
Right, the master cylinder and yeah.
Yeah.
And probably where the engineers got it from was that there was an engineering mentality, you know, and culture.
Mm-hmm.
Just two things that sparked in my mind. And one was that we started working on that. And I mean, when I say we, I mean, we as the company I work at is an open source software company. And we've got our hands in a lot of different pies and are able to help influence to different degrees what's going on there. And so last summer, we started an initiative to change specifically the two sets of terms for blacklist and whitelist and then master and slave on a technical coding level. And uh-huh. We got a number of projects that Red Hat's got direct, you know, activity and can go in there and make influence and make the changes happen and a dashboard to track it and so forth. So it's a long, slow process because some instances are much easier to change than others. And ultimately, you've got to give every group a chance to really think about the technical aspect of it. And all you can ask people to do is put it on the roadmap and do the work. It's not something that can be flipped overnight. But on the other side, you've got, because all of this dynamic happened, one of the large code repositories in the world on GitHub changed last summer. They'd been using master as their primary default name for the software branch. And they not only went through and made the default main, they went ahead and wrote a bunch of tools so that it made it easy for those of us who had repositories there to just click a button and have it switch over. And did all of that transparently so people knew it was coming and we knew whether to try to do it manually now or wait and so forth. So it definitely brought everybody up. The question I wanted to ask that came out of what Simon was asking, though, is what I think or said was that we were talking about highly, you said highly, I think you used the phrase highly offensive to some. I think that's what my thesis around simplified language versus the other block first is that when we put simplified language first, it focuses more on trying to create understanding and then second, and then says, and some people will find this offensive. And I think that the term master and slave should be found offensive by everybody. Like highly offensive by everybody, and it should be something, you know, and it's okay if it takes us a generation or two to really kind of come around on that thinking, but that was really what ultimately got me to want to put the people first on the language or the, you know, the one, it was because of that aspect of it was realizing that, you know, this should be a problem to everybody who's receiving it and not let people off the hook easy with, well, just go ahead and use the simplified. Yeah, I'll just do this. I'll let you all get away with it. Just use a simplified term, you know, and not own up to the fact that they're clinging on to, you know, a terrible thing.
Well, I think what you're saying has a lot to do with there are assumptions behind changing terms and making them more inclusive. And some of those assumptions are attached to believing that systemic or structural oppression is a thing, that it exists. If we don't believe that, it's harder to say, to rationalize inclusive terms, because it's like, we don't need to change, the individuals need to change. So what needs to change? And if the corporation or the organization finds itself complicit or as part of a systemic structure that could be oppressive, then it is in its best interest to review its practices. And I think it's overwhelming right now because you mentioned terminology being phased out. You know, we're going to choose these two terms. But I think people, I read a New York Times article. I think I shared the link with you all about inclusive language. Came out November 1st. And some people feel overwhelmed, I think, by the sheer number of things that they have to change in their vocabulary. And then they feel very confused. And I'm sure that some people would say, it's your turn to be confused. Not my problem, right? But it's happening. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's happening at a higher frequency than it has in the past. I remember one of the first words that I had to change in my vocabulary was blackboard. And now we have an app named Blackboard. So we had to change from calling the actual physical chalkboard from blackboard to chalkboard.
Right.
And now we have this learning management system called Blackboard. Okay. I don't know how that happens, but it was one word, you know, and one word at a time gives you a chance to ease into it.
Yeah.
These people are overwhelmed by a lot of words at a time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's great if you can get someone to drink from a fire hose and change a lot of things all at once. But sometimes you have to go in a more subtle approach and change a few things, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes just by changing those few things, they start to open up to, you know, maybe there's some other things. I don't know. What have you run into when you tried to change people's language to use more inclusive words?
I think there are three, you can divide people into three camps when you're trying to get them to change language. And I will speak from personal experience. The majority of people, if you say this term is actually offensive, we'll say, oh, I didn't know that. I'm sorry. I didn't mean anything by it. And change. That's mm-hmm. I think that's the majority of people, certainly the majority that I've encountered. Mm-hmm. There is a small, so there's that foxhole, you know, defending the existing language. There is another foxhole farther back where people will argue the point. And it's an easy foxhole to be in. And I must say, the four of us got together 2 weeks ago and I found myself arguing from that second foxhole. I said, what am I doing afterwards? Where you can look at the etymology of a word. I'll say blackboard, I'll play dumb. I have not heard that term being changed before. And I say, well, it's a blackboard because it's black and it's the right term. And you know, no one could take offense to that. And that's a mistake because you shouldn't judge what other people are offended by. And it doesn't really matter to me what we call it, but you know, that's where that term comes from. So that's the software engineer saying, this is the right word. This is where it comes from. It's not offensive in its origin. So you should not be offended by it. It's not really a place that you want to be. And unfortunately, and I will say it out loud, there is a small, very small foxhole, the last foxhole, which is people who use the word because they know it's offensive.
Right. Well, there's instigators.
And I like yeah. that. Yeah. I could name names. You know,
yeah. they reveal themselves.
You don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be in that foxhole.
Yeah. You don't want to be that person, right?
Oh, you don't.
Well, and it's funny when Lucia mentioned Blackboard, I never really thought about it's. And this is the thing. I'm like, you know, the one in the room is like, oh, really? I never really thought about that. I listened to Larry give a great presentation about like creating a dictionary of words that are used. And he was bringing up phrases. I'm like, I never really thought about that. Mm-hmm. And the blackboard, I would never really think about, but it really is a chalkboard. Like that really is a more accurate description because blackboards aren't always black. Sometimes they're blue.
Or green or brown.
Or green.
Or orange.
Yeah, but they're all chalkboards.
So I mean, I honestly don't know if the reason for changing. I just remember being told we're not going to call this, and I was like, okay, that's fine. It is a chalkboard, like your reaction, right?
Yeah.
I think the one that I've encountered the most resistance to recently, not personally, but in work or in social context, is the they. Pronoun. So people will say, no, that is not a gender. And
oh,
Boom, shut that. I mean,
they say that's not, they don't argue from the position of that's not proper grammar and that's not how I was taught and that kind of thing. Because
well, it starts that way, but maybe in Stephen's notion of foxholes, they start backing into foxholes where we end up when this is not a gender.
You really find out what the underlying art concern.
Because what I end up doing most of the time is saying, well, did you know that they was used before he and she? And so the origin of they, and then, oh, well, it's not a gender. Okay, so then we end up there. And then we have to have a deeper conversation. And am I going to have that conversation with somebody at the university? Yes, we can, but at a cookout or at a family gathering, it depends.
One of the things that comes up, and I don't know if this comes up in other organizations as much, when you have a global organization, a lot of times it's going to be like a company or somewhere where you've got an ability to at least manage the debate and do some change management and culture processes. But the open source software is a global thing, and you've got people coming from lots of different companies or individuals coming in there. And mm-hmm. So that's where the cultural, I just don't see why this is a problem thing comes in, and where you really got this, okay, I need to go back and, you know, like here, let's bring up the 1619 project. Let's, you know, try to get people and get them from basics, because it's not in their culture. But what is in the culture might be something like, you know, oppressive autocratic regimes controlling language for the last 100 years. And so there's a super sensitivity around when you come in sounding like you're trying to control language. And so then once that clash starts, it's like you're going to end up with people who are going to say things that they shouldn't have said, you know, in public or in whatever. And that culture can come out just across the software thing. So I don't know. That's one thing we've come across that's a little bit different than other cases.
Well, and that's an interesting perspective. And from that perspective, it might be easier to approach things from simplified language perspective and put simplified language first. And everybody understands that. Then I'm not like pushing against the, we have to use inclusive words.
Right. I feel like we've been using the simplified language argument. In technical communities, we talk about making things translatable and trying to get people to work, get away from idioms and so forth as mm-hmm. well. Right. So I know the argument does work, but it also feels to me like it's a, one probably doesn't want to let people off the hook. I guess, you know, like to Lucia's point, like if we just keep, just let them actually say what they're really talking about so we can really have the real conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like the way I gauge these, how far should I go is to what extent can I connect with this person? Because that's what it's about. It's, and it goes back to the beginning of this conversation. We're talking about connecting with a person. It reminds me of patient physician interactions, right? The physician doesn't have to connect with you. They can just tell you what you have in technical terms and then send you on your way. Mm-hmm. But there is an element of persuasion so that you can comply with medical treatment, mm-hmm. ideally.
It's a strong component, you're right.
So if they connect with you, and so some of these people, I just am like, am I going to engage? If I engage this person, you know, how futile, how exciting, how detrimental to my marriage? I don't know. You know, if a relative...
What length? Yeah.
89 years old and, you know, yeah. To what extent am I making that argument?
Right. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, to go back to the they, I can tell you from a long, long experience that at one time, I think examples, and I have a particular bugaboo about examples, there would be examples where it was all men and it would be he. Mm-hmm. And a long time ago, what we were told was don't do that. Try to make it plural. If you can pluralize things, then it's they, but it's they plural, and that's grammatically fine, and it's not singling out a gender or an individual. I've also seen people alternate in examples between a user he and a user she. They actually is the easiest way to do it.
It is, so, isn't it?
I'm kind of used to pluralizing things. It does take some work, but it might be a little less work just to use they.
I think it is.
It's writing he or she.
The he, that was the most cumbersome thing of all, was the he, she with a slash.
Oh, he slash she?
Yes.
Tried that too.
But and in the end, I tell people, when I do have certain reports, like, in the end, why not call somebody by the name they want to be called? Like, why is it your burden? Why is this, just use the preferred pronoun? Who cares? But am I, don't know, maybe that's not a very good argument from their perspective.
But then it almost forces people to explain why it is that they won't, like, why is it so, like, again, it's just back, you know, let people back themselves until they're actually revealing what their real point is, that they've got some reason why their word is more important than your, you know, emotional experience or anything else, right?
Mm-hmm. In terms of technical terms, you talk about resistance. The one I hear, and I think I saw a question flash across the chat, people say, well, we've always used this. Everyone in our field knows what it means to kill a program.
Right.
Everyone in our field knows what it means to abort a task.
Oh, yeah. Don't change it. The word.
They won't understand the alternative. Well, they will understand the alternative because, like, the rules of plain language, they probably have heard it before and know what it means. Just like everyone knows what main means, they don't have to say master. But that's what you hear sometimes. And of course, it's rife throughout our software. We can't change all the code. Well, okay, yeah, sometimes you can't change the code. Maybe you can rewrite the error message. Maybe you can update the UI screen. Or maybe for the next version of the product, you can be a little more sensitive.
Right, you can start getting
the word out. We've always done it this way, and people won't understand if you don't call it the same thing. Well, we're
all on that. I think there's something interesting to that also, I don't know if I was having a conversation about journals, but something that came up wherever this conversation was, and I apologize if the interlocutors of that conversation remember this differently, but we were talking about when offensive language has been used in journal articles of the past. Do you go back and create kind of a correction or a, I don't know, an amendment? Do you just say, you know what, this is offensive, and this is the way that things got published before? So I don't know, like, to what extent do we make amends?
And she is frozen.
Do you go back and rewrite the speeches of the great orators of the 19th century?
Right.
I think you frame it in a historical context.
Or just leave it as part of history. Maybe it was
actually, if necessary, footnote, you know.
Yeah. Say,
at the time, this was considered the acceptable term for whatever.
We're educating as we go without, yeah.
Yeah, rewriting history is a slippery slope.
That is a slippery slope.
We can rewrite the future, though, by using inclusive.
Right, we can go forward. We can take the here and now and go forward. And I think it's interesting to have, like, that footnote, you know.
Mm-hmm. And that can make all the difference, because I guess I had a really, Larry brought up one of the words before that I had a really strong reaction to in that moment, because I'd had I hesitate to bring it up, at least without a content warning. I mean, we are talking about inclusive language, but let's just be aware. And it's the word abort, and it's not like, oh, okay, you know, whatever. But content warning means that, you know, I'm going to have to resist from swearing as I'm telling this experience, because this inclusive language group was working on words, and we were talking about that particular word. And in the course of the hour, my experience was, I came in thinking, well, I don't want to get into, I want to, you know, recognize this word, the context of, you know, medical procedure, and then the software context, and make sure that people are aware and not try to politicize it or bring it into those dynamics. And then we talked about how people's personal experience might be of just coming across that, and, you know, all these different dynamics. And then somebody just said, well, but that's the origin of the word in the context. I'm like, well, what do you mean? So I had no idea. In the middle of this meeting, I dropped in and I go look it up, and the word abort, literally the origin of the word, only has ever meant to terminate a pregnancy. a determinant of a person's pregnancy. So that's its origin, right? And so in that meeting, I suddenly realized, you know, what do we have in programming? We have a parent process and we have a child process and we abort that process. And I just suddenly had this flash, and it goes to what, you know, like the who are those programmers 40 years ago who are writing all of this stuff? Is it, you know, is it a bunch of, it's, and it's not just, you know, are these men actually just being unintentionally offensive, or is it a little inside joke that is basically saying this is the boys' club and it's where this is, right? And so that was, I decided that that's what that was. There is no way that threading process, and I, you know, I wasn't there who wrote it. Maybe the person's still alive and they say, no, that wasn't it at all. But I can't imagine how you could accidentally come up with those combinations of words to directly, you know, reflect that.
Well, and then, but then back to, you know, back, at, you know, 40 years ago, we talked different than we talk now. Culturally, we were different. Culturally, our sensitivities were a lot different 40, 50 years ago than they are now. Yeah. And then a lot of this language, they would use it to try and get you to understand emotionally, viscerally, what they're trying to communicate. So it might not have been intentional to be exclusive of people, but it was intentional use of the word for the emotive value as well, to train and educate. But society, we've evolved, thank goodness. And now we're seeing these words are not sensitive and they're not necessary. We could be more accurate with our words. So they're not required anymore. We said it 50 years ago. It doesn't mean we need to say it now and into the future, right?
And whether you use Larry's argument that it's better to include people, or my argument that it's bad to exclude people, either way, you can approach it from either direction. I hear Carson in particular talking about trying to engage people and get at the root, why are they using the word? And I guess I kind of shy away from wanting to have this conversation for fear of finding out that perhaps one of my coworkers is using the word because they want to.
Right.
But you can just sidestep it and say, for this reason, the reason of inclusivity, and that reason, not wanting to exclude, don't do this. Mm-hmm. I can just agree on that point. I don't want to open up the black box of the person's skull and see if they're genuinely ignorant of it, or don't think we should change, or don't want to change.
And some people like to be obstinate and not change, and that you're not going to change that in them. Right.
And that's an important caveat, because I should thank you very much for bringing that up, because that's definitely my attitude about it. And it's not that I definitely don't take that attitude in all instances. I try to be, you know, like wise in my communication, but I do personally have a willingness to go there with, and basically it's because the most likely people to have an evolution in their thought talking with me are going to be other white men, in case it's not obvious, or if you're just listening to this, I'm a white man in my early 50s. So people like that who identify with me or connect with me are more likely to process this stuff better and more likely to go to that genuine thing. And then mm-hmm. I can hear what's up with it. And I've had these conversations, and it's, it's not easy, but I, you know, that at least that's there. So yeah, so that's something that I can do. And I definitely don't recommend it to anybody, especially if you're not in the position of being where the other person is comfortable identifying with you, then now you're at risk, you know, because they're most likely not part of not part of an underrepresented group in that situation. If they're, you know, so forth. I mean, yeah.
I hasten to add, I'm not criticizing your approach. I mean, over mm-hmm. beers, we could have that conversation. I was just thinking in terms of within a business, within an organization.
Yeah, and I'm agreeing with you.
And why do we make these changes? That's all.
I'm agreeing with you. I'm making a difference between my personal advice versus my organizational. Yeah, I so heartily agree.
Well, I like Karsten's point too, that he's talking about. And that's, I think, one of the nice things about this eclectic group that's come together to talk about this topic is relatability. Is sometimes people can relate to somebody else easier than they can relate to you, right? So I think, you know, if we're trying to influence change, we kind of have to let go of the ownership of how they're responding. And perhaps someone else who's saying the same thing, they'll hear differently. Like my mother, God rest her soul, used to tell the story about how she'd tell us, look both ways before you cross the street. And she drilled this into us all the time. came home from kindergarten. My mom told me this story for years, so it's imprinted in me. And I told her, "Mommy, Mommy, guess what I learned?" And she said, "What did you learn today?" I learned that when you get to the sidewalk, you have to stop and look both ways before you cross the street. I didn't hear it from her. I heard it from somebody else.
And she went.
She was upset with it for the rest of her life. But the lesson is that the more we talk about these things and have conversations, and the more people can relate to more people having these conversations and those aha moments, like Blackboard. I don't know what to call the whiteboard that I have. I'm sure there's another phrase for that one.
Dry erase board.
Even more so.
Dry erase board. There you go.
And even more so, people who don't have that culture. Maybe if the problem is a lack of education with because of a cultural background difference, for example, you know, talking to my friends and colleagues in Western Europe, and then again, I'm a safer place to have that conversation and ask those questions and say, "I really don't get why you all hung up on this problem." And say, "Well, let's talk about it then," and like that's going to get it brought better, right? So.
And when we try to do that, you know, Janice, at the very beginning, you mentioned dictionaries or word lists.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of companies are updating their style guides, including mine, to add, you know, don't use this term, use these others. And when we work on this in the Inclusive Naming Initiative, we stress the rationale. Here's an alternative. Usually here are more than one alternatives, the one that fits your context. And then the rationale, here's why we're telling you that this is sensitive. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, we're just not a bunch of people hitting you over the head with a style guide. Right. There's a reason for this, and it's been well thought through, and we'd like to tell you what that reason is.
I think that's great that that hits all of the foxholes. Here is an I don't know what else to say. Here is an alternative. I don't know why this is a big deal. This is why.
Yep.
That's great.
Well, maybe the last foxhole is still going to be dug in.
You're
not going to be able to change it.
But at least we'll change everybody else.
Yes, that's a great majority of them.
Yes. Yeah, it's up to them to change themselves. And, you know, sometimes you have to just conform to the style guide.
And part about the Inclusive Naming Initiative thing, too, is it's a bunch of different corporations coming together for different companies and projects to work on this. So and it's being done in an open and transparent manner so that you'll be able to even see that people from the different companies are, you know, their fingerprints, their commits are in the Git log and so forth that you can actually check. So it creates that it's not just me, it's not just my team, it's not just my company, it's the industry is shifting. You know,
it's a collaboration and open source. Do we have a link to that that we can share with people?
Yeah, it's inclusivenaming.org, I think. Is that
Well, we'll put it in the show notes too.
Yeah, I think it's
so everybody can access it. Yeah.
That's all you need. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that one's particularly focused on the technical communication aspects of things. And so not necessarily in like the marketing or sales or other aspect of things, but around, you know, docs, pubs, and
user interfaces, Karsten.
And user interfaces.
I think that's one of the strengths of the organization. I think it's both software programmers and technical writers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to deliver a little bit of a mea culpa here. I was going to say, and then I saw someone mention in the chat that I'm bringing in war terms like foxhole. That's an example of it. I would amend it to suggest that we don't have to think of it as an adversarial or fighting relationship. We can really be change agents because we can change documents much more easily than engineers can change code. But we can be in the forefront of these changes by pointing out, as Larry has said, this is an alternative. This is why what we're doing can be problematic. Here is an alternative. Why don't we use that? This is best practice. This is what open source community wants to do. This is what many companies want to do. So it doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be adversarial.
And fixing things is just as easy as what Stephen just demonstrated. You say, "Oh, you know what? Let's use a different term than foxhole because that is a militaristic term," and just move it on.
Well, but if you're writing for the defense industry, and you're talking with a lot of ex-military people that are tech writers now, they would understand it. So sometimes the audiences, the foxholes, they get it.
I'd love to take that excuse, but I won't. I won't.
Even though I've been teaching English and have a pretty good command of it, I didn't know what foxhole was until you said it right now. And when I imagine somebody backing up into a foxhole, I just imagined their little, like a little shelter, like a little.
It is a little ground, shelter. But I didn't. Yeah.
Okay. I was imagining.
It probably comes back. It probably goes back to the time where they did hunting, where the origin of the word guy came from. An old English hunting term, and guy was an insult. Actually, it was not a very good thing. Yeah. I have to go look. My grandmother for years would get upset if I ever used the word guy, you guys. And it went back to the English hunting. So, and then that's what the foxes would do. They hide in a hole to get away from the hounds.
But here you see an example of somebody who genuinely did not even understand the analogy that I was making. So it's not a perfect analogy if it left someone behind.
Right.
And that's where, so I live in a border community, right, in El Paso, Texas. So those things happen all
the time. Which is another good representation of why we change our language to be more inclusive, because somebody's going to nod and act as if they know what you're saying, but they don't, right?
They might even use the term that you like I did.
Or people use it, you know, the accurate word, use the term and continue it on. So sometimes we'll have a term that might be a few generations old, that where the meaning has been lost a little bit in the past. I think of grandfather as one of those where it's been over 100 years since that term was in use and where its origin comes from. But I'd never come across what that meant until I came across it, right? And it was one of those. So
which term?
Oh, grandfather.
Grandfather
Dan. It's a Jim Crow practice, I believe. It was that you had to pass the literacy test to be able to vote. And the problem is that the problem, right, was that a lot of white men weren't literate. But if your grandfather had been allowed to vote before or whatever, then you got you got grandfathered in instead of having to pass a literacy test. Yeah. So it's getting a really difficult history when you get into it. I mean, that's not.
I only learned that a few years ago. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how phrases can hide in our everyday conversation.
Sure.
The one that I think has been a very simple change for me, but meaningful, is in citations. I used to say, see such and such and such and such. Now I say refer to blah, blah, blah. Because it's more inclusive. And yes, there are people who have, they don't use their vision to read what you're writing. And
right.
Wow.
But recent previous employer was beginning to make that change from see to refer to. Mm-hmm. The person told me that and said, really? Oh, is that because it is? Yeah, that's why. I said, okay. And it's genuinely, I personally don't care at all. I just have to remember to do it. And then I came to my current employer and I said, do we say C or refer to it? And they said, oh, we say C. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm ahead of the curve.
I don't know what.
But yeah, refer to is the accurate word, really. And C is kind of a one that you have to learn what it means. And there's some that I wonder about. I think where even the offensiveness is right there in its name. The one that always gets me is gets under my skin, shall we say, is the drink the Kool-Aid analogy. We have people who are, city member of Congress who was there. That, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in that thing. It's not like an ancient history. But I also think that what might be going on there is that people are doing a thing of conflating the electric Kool-Aid acid test, which was a Bay Area thing from the 60s with the Kool-Aid this, and the idea that the electric Kool-Aid acid test was sort of like dropping acid and following the Grateful Dead around. And that's the kind of connotation that people use the phrase, drinking the Kool-Aid in. Because there is no other connotation for drinking the Kool-Aid other than committing mass suicide for a cult, right? So it's like it's very strange. But so I've been thinking about it. I'm like, I think that's actually what it is. It's a conflation of the terms, and probably came out of the Silicon Valley, which is right around the block from where the Kool-Aid acid test actually happened, and trying to basically, it was basically a way of saying those hippies just going along with that whatever thing because they drank the Kool-Aid or something.
That's so funny, because when you say they drank the Kool-Aid, I never think of the acid test. I never think of that. I think of a different, very negative, very scary situation where people drank Kool-Aid. So I don't even think about the
acid. But I'll bet people younger than 40 who are listening would have to go Google it.
That's why my replacement is something like, you know, drop the acid and follow the band or something, instead of if they're gonna go look up a term, at least they won't go walk away from that term thinking, you know, being shocked and sickened at the end of it, you know.
That's why, though, man, it's like I always feel like Cousin Balky, because I am over 40 and I still have to look that up more from a cultural perspective.
Yeah.
Because I would have to kind of understand that. That's where I put my foot in my mouth the most, as a person from a different country who is an immigrant here and happily planted. But man, I'm the Cousin Balky. I always say things.
Perfect.
And Cousin Balky, I did watch Cousin Larry and Perfect Strangers.
I hate to say it, but that was after my time. I know what you mean.
It was mine too. I don't know what that is.
He would always say he was from an unknown country, and he would always misuse idioms and those colloquial phrases.
Well, malapropism in some cases, and
yeah.
Yes, to like a terrible detriment.
I don't think this comes up much in technical writing, except when you are trying to make an analogy. This is like that. That you might be tempted to reach for something and these things might come in. But they are very culture specific and very age specific. And we kind of get locked into our personal vocabulary and toolkit of analogies. Mm-hmm. And times pass us all by. Three quick examples of things that really have happened. To me personally, I've been using the show business expression, break a leg before people do presentations. And I thought everybody knew what that meant. No longer so much. I've had people start to look at me funny, say, why would you want me to break my leg? I didn't mean it that way.
Cruel.
Yeah. I once used the word bigwig in a meeting. You know, what do the bigwigs want? And somebody just started laughing and laughing and laughing. And he said, I've never heard that word before. Big wig. It was just totally taken with it. It was laughing for minutes. He happened to have grown up, I want to say in Ghana, but he just had never heard the term. And, you know, whose fault is that? I shouldn't have used the term. And recently I read, it didn't happen to me, but I read about somebody who replied to an email and wanted to say, note carefully, be very cognizant of. So we put in NB. I know what that means. It's an abbreviation for nota bene, which is a Latin term, which we're told not to use because people don't understand it. Well, he found himself in front of HR because the recipient of the email, and I'll have to be indelicate here, the recipient of the email was highly offended that he would look at my email and say, no bullshit. And he had to explain, NB does not mean that. It means, you know, he found himself in that second hole. Don't use the term, but it just passed us by. That not only is it not known, it can actually be people can think it means whatever else they might think it means.
Well, so, and that's a good lead in to say, we'll never get this perfectly.
Yeah.
Our knowledge and understanding of this is always evolving, and we just do the best we can. If you wait for everything to be perfect, you'll never get started.
You'll never get there, right? And that's, you know, why I have more conversations about it and just be open and receptive, right? And change things and stop and think, am I using something that only I'm going to get or only a certain segment's going to understand? Or should I reach for something that's common for everyone to understand? It takes a little bit more work and effort, but I think, you know, the payoff's worth it. If you have more people involved and more people feeling included, more people feeling, you know, that they're a part of the conversation, right?
Yeah, exactly. And especially when people are part of the conversation with this, you know, the globally interconnected bit, we have the thing where it's like it, you can find yourself in NBA is an example one where I've never heard that in as a particular an acronym, but I saw a presentation at All Things Open recently, and the presenter was giving a great, it was about inclusive language, and it was a really good one. I'll link it in the show notes, and I don't want to give away the punchline, but basically he pulled up a Twitter feed of a particular brand that we all know, and the abbreviation of that particular brand happens to match a particular word in the Urban Dictionary. And so you could tell from their moment their Twitter feed responded, and then people's response, and like, oh, this Twitter feed is for this joke meme, right? So I mean, it's just like you're doing that. It's like doing a trademark search. You want to make sure you haven't accidentally acronymed yourself into an embarrassing situation, without going ahead with it. So
yeah,
I think we've got the pause. I want to hear what the example was. I don't want to take away his jokes or his good. I mean, his good presentation. So anyway, I will make sure to follow up with a link into the show notes for this.
That'd be great.
Yeah, it was during the Inclusion and Diversity Day on Sunday. So one of the title of the talk was LGTM, which is an expression that means looks good to me, and it comes out of. I don't know how many parts of software do that one. And my first thought when I read it was like, why would you give yourself a title like that? That's so not like how, so you have to know what that means to read it. And then of course I open it up and discover it's a talk about inclusive language and that there wasn't, that there is, I'll give you this one. If you think of it, if you look up LGTM, there may be other definitions of it out there too. And it goes into his experience around that. So, okay. Yeah. So people can go look it up right there off that definition, or I'll get the link into the show notes for you.
I guess I'll have to look it up.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me, Kirsten.
I'll stop and look right now if you don't want your time.
So how does one get started? If they're in a company that doesn't have an inclusive initiative, how does one get started?
Well, we had a relatively easy time, I think, because our company was starting to turn a lot of focus on diversity and inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
We have an executive level sponsor for that mm-hmm. initiative, and they're starting some identity groups, I guess might be the best term, mm-hmm. People who consider themselves part of a certain community. And so coming along and saying, we want to do this inclusive language because of these same kinds of concerns, the bigwigs, the powers that be, were quite receptive.
Mm-hmm.
And gave us a nice launch. So I think if you went to perhaps the head of HR or whoever might be involved in that sort of thing, they would be very open.
So that's one way. Try and position it to human resources as part of the bigger inclusive initiative for the company. Any other tips? I know we're a little over time, aren't we?
I think if your company has a style guide that they follow, I mean, that could be, I would try to find the best way into the conversation possible. And if it's going to be through the style guide or through HR, and then start with some small actions that like the Center for Legal Ethics, it's in the way they're writing their cases. It's just mm-hmm. about plain language. In that you're either avoiding the pronoun if because to leave it more open so that people can imagine the characters to be whoever,
mm-hmm.
and show people that it what it does.
And do start small. That was a good tip. Don't try to solve every problem first time out.
Right, right.
And it's nice to have some, if you can find people to work with too, and as much as diverse as that group can be to start really helps to. And then inviting other people in to help in review.
There are the two prongs of the argument. The you can make more money, you can avoid losing money, or you can avoid alienating people. And businesses are always receptive to either one of those arguments.
Mm-hmm. Cool. The main thing is to get started on it.
Yes.
Right. That's the main
change you want to see in the world. Yes.
And have conversations, lots and lots of conversations, because as well-intentioned as we can be, sometimes we have faux pas and we say the wrong thing and we don't realize it, right? Until someone else brings it to our attention or until we stop and think about it. Because you don't want to put it on someone else to tell you you're saying this wrong, it's offensive to me, because that puts them on the spot, right?
That's a good point.
I'll just follow up with, when someone comes to you, they're not trying to make you feel bad. They're trying to help generally, right? So being open and receptive to correction can go a long way too.
Right.
Improvement.
Yes. And if we're trying to get buy-in from people who might be a little resistive, well, any pointers on that one?
It is much more persuasive rather than to say, I think this could be offensive to some other group that's not represented in the conversation. If it is true, it's much more effective to say, it is offensive to me. Mm. And that's very hard to argue with. But it has to be true.
I've also had moments where I dig up research and I show them, you know, these are the alternatives. You could go this route or this route. And these are the implications of one route and these are the other. This is the history. Just, it's work, but it shows them a little bit of substance of why.
Yeah, that rationale again. Hey, we've given mm-hmm. this some thought. And you know, put an organization in, perhaps it's your own company's style guide authors, or perhaps it's something bigger than that, like Inclusive Naming Initiative. This is a best practice, and there's a large community that says so.
Yeah.
Powerful words. Best practice is a powerful phrase.
Yeah. And I think getting also, when you're keeping around, especially if you've got a business situation where we're focusing on being able to make money and do good in the marketplace, right? The science is pretty much in on the advantages of being a more diverse business in terms of how much money you make and how much more innovation you can have. I mean, even just in this conversation, we can see that because we come from different backgrounds, we've had to work through and explain things to each other and check things that mm-hmm. If we just all assumed everybody knew what a foxhole was and moved on and never paused for that, then, you know, we miss these opportunities. And so I know that it can be, you know, diversity can be treated as like a hot button issue for people, but it feels like it's another one of those red herrings, because if what they're really doing is trying to be racist, then that's what they're being, right? It's not, because the facts belie the arguments no matter what, which kind of gets to Lucia's point. Like there's a body of evidence to counter what your mama told you, and you know.
And I think it's good to do the research, because not everybody, you know, I'm a Latina, but I'm not representative of every Latinx or Latino or Hispanic. There's a lot of nuance. And so asking people what they prefer to be called, there's a lot of people here on the border who don't want to be called Latinx and they don't use that term. And so, you know, it gets complicated because we have to choose something at some to write a document or to
we do
the business.
Yeah, we do. And I think that goes to the argument of, you know, inclusive language, a little challenging to do, but it creates a simpler, more easy to understand language to communicate to a broader audience, right? It's just about making things simpler. And I think that might be a good argument for some people, so that they're not so possessive over some phrases. It's accuracy. A chalkboard is a chalkboard. Regardless of the color of the board, it's a chalkboard because you use chalk on it. That's the purpose, right? So.
Well, we will continue to grapple with the more complex ones.
Yeah, and chip away at them little by little, but never give up the fight, because we're all on a path of evolution. And you know, generations after us are going to get it better and better and better. But that's what we're here to do, try to make things better, right?
And I always remind people that what we're doing here as a metaphor is planting olive orchards, olive groves, right? Which is to say, we're planting trees that we are not going to bear the fruit of in our lifetime, but in hopes that the future is a better place for the effort we put in.
Yes. And sometimes some of these things that you're doing by putting in inclusive language, the words that you're choosing, you are shaping society and you're shaping cultures for the future, like Karsten points out, because those words that we use, the ones that are oppressive, continue to oppress at some level, right? This has been great, you guys, and I hate to tie up this conversation, but we've gone way over time. So Liz will have some edit challenges, but that's okay. I really appreciated this time, and I've gotten a lot out of the conversation.
Good working with you.
Thank you all so much.
I've learned some new words and some things I shouldn't say.
Right? That's the thing. Every time I have a conversation, I'm like, oh, okay, that I can change that.
I can change, you're right, I can too.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of the unscripted part here too, is that there's a learning aspect to this conversation.
That is very true. That's why we keep it unscripted. And look at all the lessons we learned just in this hour together.